Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Can I just advise the minister not to hit this Clayton Yields display here, because when you do, or if you do, exciting things happen. Lights go on and off, windows go up and down. So it's great to have Craig Emerson back at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him very briefly. He has a very varied background. He's an author. He's worked in universities. He's worked as a political staffer in the Hawke Labor government. He's worked at universities and the public service. But of course, since 1989, he's been the Labor member for Rankin. He held a number of senior shadow ministry positions in the Labor opposition. But since the election of the Rudd Labor government, Dr. Emerson is Minister for Small Business, Independent Contractors and the Service Economy, as well as Minister assisting the Finance Minister on deregulation. He's appeared at the Sydney Institute some years ago, and this is his second appearance, talking tonight on prosperity and fairness in a market economy. Craig Emerson, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you, and I'll do my best not to upset the electronics so carefully erected by Jerry, who's an electronics nut. We know that for a very long time. I did want tonight to speak more in my capacity as the Minister assisting on deregulation. Some of what I have to say is relevant to small business, but I thought that overwhelmingly you'd be interested in an overall political philosophy. And so this is an ambitious project of mine that I've been working on for about 25 years. So here it is. This is it. I want to propose to you tonight a unifying political philosophy that embraces the universal values that were reaffirmed in the Millennium Declaration and applies them to public policy making. Embedding these values, and they are freedom, equality, solidarity, tolerance, respect for nature and shared responsibility, into a political philosophy offers the prospect, I believe, of creating a new political consensus on a future direction for Australia. That political philosophy, prosperity and fairness through opportunity for all in a market democracy, finds a comfortable home in the Australian Labor Party. When last in government, Labor made itself the party of competition and compassion, a tradition that has been carried on now by the Rudd government. But in the application of this philosophy, the Rudd government acknowledges that the policy approaches of the 1980s and early 1990s need both renovation and innovation as we develop modern responses to the new challenges of the 21st century. In this political philosophy, the role of policymakers is to allow the market to create prosperity, and out of that prosperity to expand opportunity, not the welfare state. In the market democracy so fashioned, citizens enjoy freedom, self-fulfillment and sovereignty over the state, not subjugation to the state through financial and regulatory welfare. This is the philosophy of like-minded people whom I call market democrats. The modern Labor champions of the traditional Labor values of prosperity, fairness and compassion. Market democrats harness the power of the market for the public good. They dedicate themselves to remedying social disadvantage out of the prosperity so created by giving every child the opportunity of a quality education through excellence in teaching and high quality school facilities. Market Democrats understand, though, that simply providing opportunity to the underprivileged does not, of itself, guarantee that it will be taken up. That's why Market Democrats support underprivileged children and their families through early childhood development and other early intervention programs. In my remaining time tonight, I'll take you through my thinking and condense it into 10 beliefs of Market Democrats as a guide to public policy making in the 21st century. Then I'll happily invite questions and comment from you, the audience, in the hope of a robust and rewarding exchange of views. To begin this thinking, we need to ask this question. Are markets immoral, impersonal devices that sap citizens of their decency and humanity, or are they a vehicle for achieving a prosperous and fair society? To answer this, we need to determine whether the driving force behind markets, self-interest, is moral or immoral. As an 18-year-old Catholic churchgoer who had just cast my maiden vote for the formation of the first federal Labor government in 23 years, that was back in 1972, I began to question the morality of self-interest. Could self-interest be reconciled with a social conscience? Bombarded by the strong convictions of Sydney University's left-wing political economy lecturers Ted Wheelwright and Frank Stillwell, and then the equally strong convictions of right-wing orthodox economics professors Warren Hogan and Colin Simpkins, I know you will have some sympathy for me, I struggled with the motivation behind giving money to the church coffers during Mass. I was 18. Wasn't this really an act of selfishness, driven by a desire to feel better about myself? How is this any different to tax avoidance by the rich? Itself an act of selfishness by people who gladly accepted the benefits of shady green parks, law and order and defence of their country without contributing to their cost. Now obviously, these are the debates of the great philosophers, but they do go to the heart of value judgments about the morality of a market economy, or as it was then known, capitalism. 3 years later, my church going had become a little more sporadic. As an honest student in economics, I ploughed through the writings of Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and Karl Marx. Both Ricardo and Marx drew inspiration from Smith. Marx married Smith's labour theory of value with his own values in intellectualising a moral superiority of workers over capitalists and the collective over the individual, a marriage whose offspring were socialism and communism. Marx is correctly identified as the father of socialism. But how ironic it is that Smith's supporters and critics regard him as the father of laissez-faire capitalism, when he was in truth a staunch critic of powerful business interests and a champion of public education for the children of the poor. Smith, the professed father of capitalism, warned that admiration for the rich and powerful was the great and most universal cause of the corruption of our moral sentiments. And he fingered contemporary government as a conspirator with the wealthy against the poor. Smith accused business people, merchants, of constantly conspiring against consumers. In their conspiracies, merchants enlisted the support of governments to protect them from competition at the expense of consumers, causing Smith to warn that, and I quote, the proposal of any new law or regulation of commerce that arises from the merchant class ought always to be listened to with great precaution. But if these systems of preferment were removed, Smith saw virtue in the freedoms so created. He considered openness and freedom would yield social good through the power of self-interest. You'll recall him saying, it is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. He was saying that prosperity is gained through this invisible hand of buyers and sellers pursuing their self-interest in an open competitive economy. Yet Smith did not see this as a utopia. He foresaw the debilitating effects of the division of labour in an industrial revolution that had not yet begun, predicting that menial repetitive behaviour would create men, quote, mutilated and deformed. Well, as a 21-year-old, I began to see the world as Smith had, that the most prosperous nations were those with open competitive economies, whose individuals are motivated by self-interest, but that these societies were by no means free of injustice and disadvantage or of moral corruption. It was not until I reached the age of 29 that I joined the Australian Labor Party as a recently appointed economic advisor to Senator Peter Walsh in the new Hawke government. Peter did not insist on party membership, but on rigour in defence of a strong economy and the truly disadvantaged, as opposed to rent-seeking spivs, hairy-legged Stalinists and anyone guilty of economic treachery. As a new recruit to the ALP, I again began to ask, is there truly a conflict between self-interest and moral behaviour, and is there a conflict between morality and markets? Well, some say that competitive markets bring out the worst in us, greed and avarice. Oddly, they don't say the same about the Olympic Games, football or cricket, netball, music and dance competitions, all based on our most competitive instincts. As Bob Hawke used to advise me as a fresh recruit to his staff in 1986 when teaching me the intricacies of betting on horse racing, he said, "Son, in any race, back the horse called self-interest, because you know it'll be trying." But self-interest is not synonymous with selfishness. An athlete is not selfish for wanting to win a tournament, but is self-interested. A singer is not selfish for wanting to win Australian Idol. An artist is not selfish for wanting to win the Archibald Prize, nor is an author for wanting to win the Booker Prize. A scientist is not selfish for wanting to achieve a breakthrough ahead of other scientists. Athletes, singers, artists, dancers, authors and scientists are self-interested, but this does not necessarily make them selfish. Some may be arrogant and rude, some may be selfish, others humble and altruistic, but all are self-interested. Without self-interest, economic and social progress is impossible. The Hawke government began opening up the economy, dismantling the regulatory shackles that had been progressively applied over decades of what were mainly conservative governments. Labor was making itself the party of competition and compassion. Out of the proceeds of growth, the Hawke government was lifting school completion rates and supporting the parents of poor children to ensure that they were able to keep them at school. My moral questions were being answered through the competitive yet compassionate philosophy of the Hawke and Keating governments, a philosophy that sat easily with Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments and the Wealth of Nations. There was, I concluded, no inherent conflict between markets and morality. So what does this mean for us today? At the start of the 21st century with a new Rudd Labor government in Canberra, traditional values of prosperity, fairness and compassion fit well with supporting an open competitive economy that rewards effort, risk-taking and entrepreneurship, and where opportunity, not welfare, is available to all. Competition works. Competitive markets encourage innovation essential to the growth of a market economy. The forces of competition create pressure on businesses to be efficient and to come up with and apply new ideas for application in producing goods and services valued by consumers. One of the most valuable ideas put forward at the recent 2020 summit was from Jane Bennett, a Tasmanian cheesemaker. Ms. Bennett observed that, and I quote, "One of the things that Australians are not good at is permitting failure and recognising that it is a component of innovation." In this cheesemaker's experience, failure was the mother of success. It's only through trying and failing that risk takers end up succeeding. Such is the power of competition. So what of fairness? Well, fair societies can flourish in open competitive economies. By allowing self-interested behaviour in competitive markets to create prosperity and then using some of the proceeds to extend opportunity to all, a transition from self-interest to the public interest is attained. The challenge of government is not to fetter the market to achieve fairness, but to harness the power of the market for the public good. This is the philosophy of people whom I call market democrats. A modern incarnation of the traditions of the Hawke and Keating governments, later imported by Tony Blair and rebadged and refined as the Third Way. But what is fairness? Fairness has traditionally been assessed on the basis of how equally or unequally income is distributed. The social goal of greater equality of opportunities was formulated during times of material deprivation. Yet poverty in the 21st century in affluent countries, like ours, is not primarily caused by inadequate incomes, but by the interrelated influences of poor education, poor health, breakdown in social relationships, gambling, and substance abuse. Few mentally healthy, well-educated people live in poverty. If poverty in Australia is no longer primarily a poverty of incomes, but a poverty of opportunity, the goal of a fairer society is best pursued through a more equal distribution of opportunity than through a more equal distribution of income. A nation's people are not better off if all live on equally low incomes. Of course, it is unfair if the rich get richer while the poor get poorer, but why should government seek to prevent the rich from getting richer if the poor also get richer as a consequence of the wealth creation process? Albania, Bangladesh and Ethiopia have more equal income distributions than Australia, but most would agree that Australia's society is fairer. Many Australians earning below average incomes choose to forego higher pay in favour of spending more time with their families and friends or just relaxing or playing sport. By doing so, they are making measured income equality worse, but through free choice, they are making their own lives better. Can a society have more fairness only at the expense of prosperity? Well, critics of markets argue that they are inherently unfair, that they need to be regulated in the name of fairness. It was less than three decades ago when the Australian government imposed a ceiling on home mortgage interest rates, said to be aimed at preventing low-income earners from being priced out of home ownership. Banks gave loans to better-off couples with long savings histories. The poor missed out. The goal of market democrats is prosperity and fairness through opportunity for all in a market economy. Market democrats strive for a more equal distribution of opportunity. If opportunity is equally distributed, incomes in the future will be distributed more equally. Prosperity and fairness become partners, not rivals. Now, the vulnerable will fall on hard times through their lifetimes. They might lose their jobs in an economic downturn. Housing rents might soar during housing shortages, as they've done in recent times, making life especially harsh for renting-age pensioners. Emotional trauma might take the vulnerable out of the workforce. Young single mothers whose children need their care and attention will suffer financial hardship without any income support. A fair society should support the weak and the vulnerable who have low or no income earning capacity, such as the working poor, the aged poor, the mentally ill, and those so physically impaired that they simply cannot work. But for those who are out of the workforce and yet have income earning prospects, perpetual income support payments without any effort to remedy the causes of disadvantage are not the pathways to a prosperous, fair society. They are a perilous road to welfare dependency, low self-esteem and servitude to the state. Sit-down money, as Noel Pearson describes this welfareism for Aboriginal communities, has the same psychological impact in non-Indigenous communities. So what is the role of government in this market democracy? In a flourishing democracy, government serves the people. Yet at every twist and turn, governments come up with new taxes and new regulations that subjugate the people to the state. By intervening, taxing heavily and regulating, governments have sought to restrict individual freedoms, stifle initiative and inhibit self-reliance. In a market democracy, governments should serve the people instead of seeking to subjugate the people to the will of government through high taxes and heavy regulation. By allowing markets to reward hard work, risk-taking and entrepreneurship without unnecessary interference, market democrats advance freedom and self-fulfilment. Governments must not imprison the disadvantaged by subjugating them to the state, robbing them of their self-esteem and condemning them to a life of dependency. Governments must liberate them by providing opportunity for all in a truly fair society. Let us not make the disadvantaged the experiments of social engineers yearning for a different social order but lacking the stomach to practice it in their own lives. It is this social experimentation of romanticising traditional life in the harsh outback that has caused Australia's most vulnerable, our Indigenous people, to be trapped in misery. Good on Warren Mundine and Noel Pearson for exposing the immorality of those asserting moral superiority, but whose pomposity perpetuates the disadvantage of our Indigenous brothers and sisters. And good on Indigenous Affairs Minister Jenny Macklin for having the courage to set her own course. Market Democrats oppose the relentless expansion of the welfare state, where higher taxes are used to obtain revenue for recycling, often to the same people in return for political support. The modern welfare state, however, extends beyond recycling tax revenue. It's a state of ever-expanding government regulation. This regulatory welfare reinforces the culture of dependency by discouraging people from taking responsibility for their own actions and their own lives. Regulatory welfare is inimical to a market democracy since it discourages individual initiative and business risk-taking. Market Democrats think of markets first and only where necessary, strengthen or complement markets with efficient regulation. In a market democracy, regulation is justifiable in strengthening markets and in remedying market failure. But the previous Conservative government seemed to think of regulation first, presiding over what the Business Council of Australia has described over the previous decade as the creeping re-regulation of business. This is why, in a process initiated by Kevin Rudd, Lindsay Tenner and I are so vigorously working with the states and territories in cutting back on overbearing, inconsistent and overlapping Commonwealth and state business regulation. Now, regulation to establish and enforce property rights is necessary for the proper functioning of a competitive market. Why buy fruit from a greengrocer when you can steal it? Why pay people to work when you could obtain their labour through violence, coercion and slavery? Why save money when anyone can take it from your bank account? And why invent something that anyone can copy from the first day of invention? Only where property rights are clearly defined, well established and enforceable can goods, services and other property be bought and sold, and wasteful disputes about property rights kept to a minimum. But look, no one seriously claims that all markets are perfect. Departures from the competitive model are called market failure. Where market failure occurs, a case can be made for government intervention to correct for the failure. But whether or not government intervention is a good move depends on the nature of the market failure, the complexity of the task of remedying it, and the competence of the government. The circumstances of market failure are quite specific, far more specific than the wide range of situations over which regulatory welfareists seek to justify government protection and price regulation. Genuine market failure arises in circumstances of monopolies and other forms of anti-competitive behaviour, of unevenly held information, positive or negative spillovers, otherwise known in the olden days as externalities, and common resources like fisheries and water. Let's have a look at anti-competitive behaviour. Businesses conspiring against consumers undermine competitive markets. Adam Smith warned that monopoly is the great enemy to good management. Regulation against anti-competitive behaviour is essential to the efficient functioning of markets, but great care needs to be taken to ensure that competition laws and practice do not, in fact, stifle competition by protecting inefficient businesses from mergers and takeovers by more efficient businesses. Inefficient, poorly run businesses should be subject to takeovers or mergers by or with efficient, well-run businesses, as long as the resulting entity behaves competitively against other rivals. Two business rivals in an industry might be constantly at each other's throats to the benefit of consumers, while five businesses might collude against consumers through price fixing. It's not the share of businesses in a market that matters, but whether those businesses are behaving competitively. Market Democrats protect competition from business, not business from competition. That's why the Rudd government, through Competition Minister Chris Bowen, is proposing to replace the previous coalition government's so-called Birdsville Amendment to the Trade Practices Act, which is based on market share, with pro-competitive amendments based on the misuse of market power. Markets function better when information is widely dispersed. But as in so many walks of life, overly zealous regulation relating to disclosure and corporate governance can actually do more harm than good. The most visible costs of overbearing regulation are the compliance costs to all businesses, including those that are well run. But the biggest costs are less visible and more pernicious. They are the costs associated with reduced commercial risk-taking by managers. A more risk-averse business community will generate less prosperity since it will be less innovative. Remember the message of the Tasmanian cheesemaker. Everyone bears the cost, not just the affected businesses. And that's why Financial Services Minister Nick Sherry is working on dramatically simplifying the disclosure documents required of financial advisers to make them at the same time both shorter and more effective. Let's turn to these spillovers or externalities. When a business produces and sells a good or service that has wider benefits to the community over and above the benefits that accrue to the business itself, it is said to have produced a positive spillover. Innovation has wider benefits for the community, since the new ideas and inventions can be used in a range of applications beyond those available to the innovator and can spawn more new ideas. A business investing in the education and training of an employee is helping to create a more productive workforce in that business, but those skills are also valuable elsewhere, and the employer knows the employee is free to move to another business. The employer cannot capture or internalise all the benefits of education and training. Education, training and innovation are therefore said to offer positive spillovers for the wider community. And since a private provider can't capture all the benefits of investing in them, education, training and innovation will tend to be underprovided if left entirely to the market. The market fails in providing goods and services that offer positive spillovers. A role therefore exists for government in supporting activities that offer positive spillovers, and that's why governments offer subsidies or tax breaks for private sector research and development. It's why governments fund universities to undertake pure scientific research that in its own right has very little direct commercial value, but which does add to the total volume and body of scientific knowledge. And it's why governments get directly involved in education and training. Unfortunately, as we know, not all spillovers are positive. Negative spillovers are most commonly associated with environmental damage. When the costs of air, water and noise pollution are not fully borne by the polluter, market failure occurs. A business that pollutes a river or the atmosphere does not bear the full cost of producing the goods. Some of the cost spills over onto the broader community. Market democrats argue that market solutions to market failure usually will be more efficient and effective than clumsy or considered government regulations. Businesses seeking protection or new government regulations commonly seek to justify these interventions on the basis of remedying what they purport to be market failure. They assert that the playing field isn't level or that they need help against unfair competition. Some are brazen enough to claim that the penetration of imports from low-wage Asian countries is evidence enough of an uneven playing field. But since when did a level playing field require all countries to have the same wage rate? Some businesses beat a path to my door seeking cash payments, tax breaks and law changes to give them an advantage over more efficient rivals. They want the benefits of competition in the rest of the economy in the form of lower input costs, but not competition in the markets into which they sell. These public champions of Free Enterprise Australia want the government to give them a little piece of socialism in their own industries. So let's turn to the central position of expanding opportunity in a market economy. Disadvantage in wealthy countries like Australia can be traced to one major deficiency: poor education. If we can fix education, we can fix most disadvantage. Education begins in the very early years with early childhood development. Early childhood development will be impeded in dysfunctional family situations, in violent homes, in families where a parent or both parents suffer from depression or engage in substance abuse or addictive gambling. In wealthy countries, many highly intelligent, brilliant young people miss out on a good education. In the poorer communities of these countries, these bright children are inculcated with the belief that they aren't cut out to excel at school, and they certainly should not aspire to a university education. Too many teachers in poor communities struggling just to administer pastoral care Do the children of broken, dysfunctional families accept and reinforce these prejudices? A couple of decades ago, decent people rightly condemned and rejected the view of extremists that black people were genetically less intelligent than Anglo-Saxons. Chauvinists argued that women were genetically inferior to men because they had smaller brains. That ignorant, despicable argument was cut to pieces by decent people. Yet to this day, there is a general acceptance that children living in dysfunctional, welfare-dependent families just aren't as bright as those living in affluent communities. How would the better off have fared if they had instead lived in a household where the only book was a telephone book? Would they have been able to learn if every day they went to school hungry, if their mother was routinely beaten by their drunken father, if they were bashed at home, or if they were sexually abused? What makes people believe that abused, bashed, hungry children are genetically less intelligent than the children of doctors and lawyers? Isn't it equally plausible that they are just as intelligent as their better-off peers, but they never get the chance to excel? Children living in poor communities and dysfunctional families do not enjoy the same opportunity in life as those living in affluent suburbs and in positive, harmonious families. It's not their fault, and they shouldn't be condemned to an unhappy life by the circumstances into which they were born. Expanding opportunity in a market democracy starts with wiring the brains of infants through the nurturing care and intention of loving parents. Where parents cannot do this alone, governments can play a role in supporting them through early childhood development programs. Never before has the wealth of our nation been so directly connected to the well-being of our people. The campuses of our preschools, our schools, our training colleges, and our universities are the places where economy meets society, where good economic policy is good social policy. A society that loves learning is an open society, a creative society. A creative society lifts the human spirit in vibrant communities. Australia as a market democracy can be a cause for good too, in the community of nations. Rich countries condemn poor countries to ongoing poverty through barriers to imports, corrupting global markets and thwarting the efforts of developing countries to create their own prosperity. Locking poor countries out of rich country markets and then sending them aid simply masks the injustices of trade restrictions. Market democrats support global trade liberalisation as the primary remedy for poverty in poor countries. And that's why Trade Minister Simon Crean is working so hard on restarting the stalled Doha round of multilateral trade negotiations. Market democrats also accept the role of custodians of the environment, both on our ancient continent here in Australia and in the global effort to arrest environmental degradation. Market democrats consider that environmental challenges need to be assessed on the basis of the best scientific evidence, not on a desire by evangelists to create a non-market economy that eluded them upon the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s. Market-based solutions are well suited to rectifying or avoiding environmental damage. A well-designed emissions trading system allows the market to identify least-cost ways of reducing carbon emissions. And our climate change minister, Penny Wong, is working with her cabinet colleagues on that. To conclude, market democrats are the modern Labor champions of the traditional Labor values of prosperity, fairness and compassion. And so I want to finish with the 10 beliefs of market democrats. Market democrats support reward for effort, risk-taking and entrepreneurship in an open competitive economy as the best way of creating prosperity. Market democrats support individual freedom and the supremacy of the people over the state, not the subjugation of the people by the state through financial and regulatory welfare. Market democrats believe in harnessing the power of the market for the public good to attain fairness out of prosperity, not fettering the market with heavy regulation. Market democrats support government intervention only in tightly defined situations of market failure, not anti-competitive government protection and regulations. Market democrats support expanding opportunity, not the welfare state. Market Democrats support government income payments for the genuinely needy, subject to mutual obligation upon those who have genuine income earning prospects. Market Democrats support equal opportunity for every child to a high quality education as the golden key that unlocks two doors to prosperity and fairness in a competitive, compassionate society. Market Democrats support creating stronger communities and collectivism through good social behaviour encouraged by the self-esteem gained out of reward for effort. Market Democrats support full participation in the community of nations to rid the world of poverty and oppression, led by the liberalisation of world trade. And Market Democrats support the custodianship of the environment through preserving biological diversity and playing a full part in a global collective effort to limit greenhouse gas emissions. A modern Labor philosophy of prosperity and fairness in a market democracy is faithful to Labor traditions while offering creative responses to the challenges of the 21st century. I commend these ideas to you for your consideration.
Many thanks. I should say thanks also to Clayton Utz for the use of this fine facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion. Can I just ask about, you made the comment, I think it was Jane Bennett at the 2020 summit talking about the significance of failure in a economy. There is a view, which you'll be aware of, that our bankruptcy laws are a bit too harsh because they're harsher than bankruptcy laws in the United States, which seems to be more willing to accept failure than we are. Do you think the US bankruptcy laws are about right, or do you think ours are about right?
Well, I can't pretend to be an expert on the bankruptcy laws as such, but I can say that there is obviously a difference in law and also a difference in attitude. The subprime crisis in the United States was caused in part by a very noble exercise, and that was to offer home ownership through mortgages to a lot of poor people, and most of those repaid their loans and continue to do so, but a significant proportion didn't. And as I understand it, in both the United States and in the UK, just declaring yourself bankrupt doesn't really have much stigma associated with it, so a lot of people just gave back the keys and walked out. I think it is good that so many people got into those homes, but maybe that attitude to bankruptcy also then contributed to what has now been wracking world financial markets, the subprime crisis.
There's a question here.
Yes, today in the Australian, Peter Saunders from the Centre for Independent Studies said that the Rudd government is producing the mutual obligation mutual obligation on welfare recipients, which he felt is that you need both carrot and stick to get people into a large number of unemployed into work.
Sure.
As a person who believes work is valuable for you, I would like to know whether that's what you're doing.
Yeah, I think I can answer that best by relating the so-called welfare reforms of the previous government for single mothers. It was all presented as a stick, really. There was no carrot. It was all stick, and it was a pretty big one. But it was very perverse, and let me explain. What the previous government did is said that when a single mother's youngest child turns 8, she has to go off the sole parent pension and onto unemployment benefit, which is lower by about, I think, $27 a week. So it's quite a drop. And with the unemployment benefit, there's no education supplement. With sole parent pension, there was. So they actually took away the key to doing better, and that is a little bit of support, very, very modest support for education. So that was gone. And they said, well, that's going to work. That's going to drive single mums back into the workforce when their youngest child turns 8. Now, think about rational behaviour, as Adam Smith would have. If you're a mum and you've got 1, 2, or 3 children and one of them's about to turn 8 and you're faced with this prospect and also a much harsher taper and a smaller income-free area, so you're faced with all this, what's the strongest incentive going? Have another baby. Puts the whole issue off for another 8 years. And you get $5,000 from the baby bonus. So this was not an initiative designed to move single mums from welfare to work. It was an initiative designed to move single mums from welfare to welfare. And it was ill-conceived. The government actually reviewed it. The previous government reviewed it. I made these arguments loud as I could as an opposition MP. NatSem, through Anne Harding and colleagues, made this argument loudly and they didn't change it. So I'd actually be quite proud to restore incentives for single mums to move from welfare to work. But you don't just belt them over the head with a stick and say, now go and have another baby.
Question down there, and then come over here and over there. Yes,
please. Rachel Merton, KPMG. Just touching back on the deregulation part of your portfolio.
Yep.
And you know, the business welcomed sort of kind of portfolio of the deregulation. But could you give us a greater insight about the kind of the application or how the deregulation sort of agenda may sort of develop?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And I won't take too much time because you've given me a question that I could spend about half an hour on and quite gleefully. There are two areas of deregulation going on at the moment, Commonwealth only and Commonwealth, State and Territory deregulation. Lindsay Tenner is mainly handling the Commonwealth only deregulation, but as in the other area where Lindsay and I are both working on it, Commonwealth State, we're not necessarily doing it all ourselves. We're like boundary riders, making sure that it gets done. And I must say, at the Commonwealth level, our ministers are self-starting on this. For example, these disclosure documents for financial advisors, Nick Sherry, is dramatically reducing the size of those and increasing the effectiveness of them. Because people can't, they're going to read 100-page documents. They have to go and get legal advice to work out what they say and what they mean. If you get it down to a couple of pages, and that does seem feasible, then everyone's better off. The recipient of the advice and the advisor. Except the lawyers, sorry, but they miss out on a bit. But I actually think lawyers would prefer to do other work than that sort of work. That's one area. In the small business area, we're actually going to create a superannuation clearinghouse for the superannuation guarantee payments. What happens now, we support choice of superannuation fund, but if you're a small business and you've got, say, 7 employees, they might have 4, 5, 6, or 7 different super funds amongst them. That small business is now obliged to disperse the super guarantee payments to those 7 funds. And if they change staff, change funds, it all starts again. So we'll enable them to channel it into this one superannuation clearinghouse and the government will distribute that. So there's 2 examples of Commonwealth regulation. In the state area, 27, we've generated an agenda of 27 different items, from occupational health and safety to national trade licences, where it's still the situation in the 21st century that a tradesperson who wants to move, say, from Sydney over to Western Australia because there's a mining boom and maybe, say, is a plumber, has to apply for a licence to be a plumber in Western Australia. This is crazy stuff. We're looking at registering business names. A national business at present has to register its business name in 8 jurisdictions and pay 8 different fees. This is like a modern version of the old rail gauge system. We're looking at the whole financial services and consumer credit area. Already the states look like they're going to agree to mortgage broking, margin lending and major non-deposit taking financial institutions all being regulated not by 6 states and 2 territories but by the Commonwealth. So they're just a few examples of what we're doing, and I'm very, very pleased, touch wood, with the cooperation of the state governments on this. They're actually saying, yeah, this is really old-fashioned stuff. What we're trying to achieve is a way of understanding it, the coherence of it, is a seamless national market. That was called for by the Business Council of Australia and then again from the Economic Group at the 2020 Summit. We are one country. Why do we have 6 state and 2 territory markets for goods and services, which is still the case in so many areas? So we're going to rip up the rail gauges and the modern versions of the rail gauges and create, as best we can, a single seamless national market.
Am I correct in assuming that market democracy is applicable only within a country mainly, maybe not totally, but mainly, in contrast to, say, market or economic dictatorship or despotism? The latter is maybe exemplified by the super control of the oil market worldwide. Russia, for instance, controls the gas supply to certain countries.
We know OPEC itself is a cartel of some sort, and they get together and talk about how much oil to put into the markets, but there are non-OPEC countries, there are even OPEC countries that still look for and find more oil. So it's not what we would call a perfectly competitive market, I accept that. There's a question of what you do about that. There's no easy solution. If there were an easy solution, probably would have been found with the first and second oil price shock back in the 1970s. But there are other forces at play too. I'm not an expert on this either, Jared, but one way or one theory, I won't say it's mine, is that with the turbulence in the stock market, you've got a lot of people who are now saying, I don't want to be in the stock market, I'll get into commodities. And so world food prices have gone up a lot because speculators are hoarding food. Now, that's not the only reason. There's lots of other reasons too. There does seem to be evidence, at least, that that's what's happening also in the oil market, that people are saying, well, we'll gamble on the oil price going higher than $135 or $139 a barrel. So they're getting into that. No easy solutions. I wish there were. If you've got one, let us know.
We are moving on. Okay, there's a question down there.
Dr. Emerson, it sounded as though, from your enunciation of the principles of a market democrat, that the ideal industrial relations system of a market democrat might be that of a Howard government before it went down the path of work choices. Am I right in thinking that?
No, you're not. look, the Howard government asserted that it deregulated the labour market. It didn't. In fact, just by way of example, there was a clause in work choices which enabled the minister to intervene in and override each and every enterprise agreement struck around the country. I don't think that's a deregulated labour market. And I could go on with more and more examples of the regulations that were in fact contained in it. You know, this sort of Orwellian title of work choices, it actually denied. I actually believe in a democracy, people should have free choice, but there is in so many ways that employees didn't have free choice, and yet they call it work choices.
Before they went down the path. Before they went down that path. Is what they had in place before that point?
Pre-2004, is it?
Pre-2005, yeah. Look,
quick answer.
I think you'll find that the legislation that we bring in will be flexible and fair, and it'll pass that test.
Okay, so the question, Milk. Yeah.
Minister, I'd be interested in your rough estimation of what proportion of your cabinet would you categorise as market democrats? What proportion of your caucus? What proportion of the other three national economies?
Well, I'll have to pay the membership fees once I create the club. No. what I've done is articulated, I think, presented a philosophy tonight, and I think a number of my colleagues would be empathetic to that. But it's not my role, Milton, to say, now come on board. As I said at the end of my speech tonight, I encourage discussion, consideration and debate about this. And I think there are colleagues who are of this general philosophic framework. I would assert that all of my colleagues supported the philosophy of the Hawke and Keating era. I think that the Tony Blair third way is also relevant because it's my assertion that Tony Blair adopted a lot of that philosophy from the Hawke and Keating era. What I'm talking about is adapting and modernising that philosophy to meet the challenges of the 21st century. So I've only put it out tonight, and we'll find out in the coming weeks, I guess. But look, I think there'll be a fair bit of empathy, if not for each and every detail, but for that philosophy of, and what is it? Create prosperity, enable markets or allow markets to create prosperity and use some of the proceeds of the prosperity to invest in education, especially education for the disadvantaged. That way you get both prosperity and fairness and compassion.
Okay, there's a question here, and then you've got to be quick. Okay?
Yeah. You talked about having quality education and equal opportunities, which is fine, fair enough. Isn't that the easy part to provide, you know, if you've got the political will and the money to provide that? Isn't the difficult part providing motivation for students to actually take advantage
of that? Sure, and governments can't provide motivation as such, but you're right. And what I was saying through the presentation tonight is often low self-esteem leads to low motivation. And if your kid's in disadvantaged communities and you're constantly getting the message that you're not very bright, and that's what happens. Now, that's just what happens. I think it's really sad. But they get that message. And they don't think that they can rise up and break out of dependency. So my plea to you as an audience is we all have a responsibility, and what a magnificent result it would be if we actually did inculcate into these disadvantaged kids that they have the same talents as kids of very wealthy or successful parents. If we could do that, and there are some ways of doing it, maybe a little scholarship scheme. You know, Adam Smith actually proposed that. A little scholarship scheme, a small amount for the children of the poor as a kind of a reward. So, you know, he's a very far-sighted guy. Back in 1776, proposed that. But I think when I said we can't create motivation, there are some things that a government can do. But if we just change the community attitude so the kids actually feel a bit more confident, then I think we can make great progress.
Okay, so we've got a second last question here. Quick, and then we'll see if anyone else.
Yes, I'd just like to ask you specifically relationship to small business.
Yep.
If there's anything you'd like to share with us about where your priorities will be, encourage small businesses.
Yeah, sure. Consistent with this approach, there are three roles for government in relation to small business and I think business more generally. One is to do everything a government can to create the right economic environment, that is, a growing economy with low inflation. That's where small businesses flourish. It's also where other businesses flourish. That requires, as you know, disciplined fiscal policy, and so it goes on. And that's what we believe we've done with the budget that's been brought down. The Coalition wants to conduct a $22 billion raid on the surplus. That means higher inflation and pressure for higher interest rates. Second role of government in relation to small business in particular is to restore incentive, and that's through the tax system by ensuring that small businesses can keep most of what they earn. And that's why there is a tax reform program set out in the budget over 4 or 5 or 6 years. So that's how you restore incentive. But the other way you restore incentive is what I've been talking about more tonight, and that is deregulating. Get out of the way. It's these impediments to risk-taking and entrepreneurship that are holding back small business. So governments themselves have erected a lot of the disincentives or the impediments to small business. Let's pull them away. Let's pull away at that red tape imposed by Commonwealth, state and territory governments. And then the third area is to improve the overall capacity of the business community, that is, its competitiveness. That's by investing in skills, one of these areas of spillovers, investing in innovation, another area of spillovers, ensuring that we have a good, robust immigration program to meet the short-term and probably long-term shortages of not only skilled but unskilled labour. So making sure we've got the right overall economic settings, number one. Number two, remove impediments, number three, increase capacity, but all within this framework of the open competitive economy.
Final question, Stephen Miller.
Oh, thanks. I think you'd be commended for putting out, for formulating this long-range political philosophy, for putting that for discussion in the way you have. In that spirit, I listened very carefully to your discussion about what governments can do, strengthening markets and remedying market failure. I may be mistaken, but I don't think you referred to productivity. And my question is about governments not so much remedying market failure as remedying system failure. There's a lot of literature that's emerging in the productivity and innovation debate that innovation actually arises not so much from market activity but from system activity.
Mm-hmm.
And that we're systems. And so my question really, as I say, in the spirit of a long-range philosophy is, what can governments do to remedy systems and strengthen systems?
Look, it is a good point. If I was giving another speech, it would be on productivity because it is my favourite subject until tonight. And I've had a lot to say about productivity growth, just so you know. Big productivity boom during the 1990s, especially the late 1990s, based on the reform program of the 80s and the early 90s, carried on in some parts by the coalition government. From 2000 onwards, productivity growth started tapering off. 2007, flat. Zero. This is a big problem. Intergenerational report projections say that even at productivity growth of our long-term average, which is 1.75%, and the ageing of the population from 2010 onwards, we'll have the slowest rate of income growth per person since the decade of the Great Depression. Might get saved by the mining boom, but that's the kind of prognosis, the projections rather than predictions, but still, big problem. Some of what I said today I think is relevant to answering your question. The modern sources of productivity growth are here: ideas, creativity, imagination. Albert Einstein worried that he wasn't as good an imaginer as he thought he should be. My son, 17-year-old, said that he worked out the theory of relativity by imagining that he was sitting on the end of a beam of light and being projected through the universe. So he didn't just sort of, you know, get the old abacus out and come up with E equals MC squared. He thought about it and then he converted it to an equation. Ideas are incredibly powerful. They create more ideas. So for me, the remedies that I was talking about here, which are actually remedies to market failure, are also the keys to restarting productivity growth. But I think, personally, much more through investing and encouraging imagination, flair, creativity than we ever have in the past, because that will determine future productivity growth and the prosperity of Australia and the rest of the world.
Many thanks, Minister. Take a seat.
Well, I'll be very brief. We get a lot of important speeches at the Sydney Institute, and I think tonight will be one of them. It was an interesting manifesto of the market Democrats, continuing and updating the tradition of the Hawke and Keating economic reformers, and also Dr. Emerson gave us a whiff of autobiographical reflection and also an indication of substantially wide reading. So it was an important paper, a lively discussion period. It'll be up on our pod tomorrow. The paper will be published in the Sydney papers in due course, but I think before that it'll create a fair degree of attention because it was a significant contribution to what's becoming an important debate. So well done tonight, and no doubt we'll see you back in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.